From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Gelton. This is On Point. Back before the cooking channels were dominated by fast-paced competitions, there was Jacques Pepin. Through his 13 public television cooking series, Pepin taught viewers to use a knife, whisk an egg, and enjoy themselves in the kitchen. These days, he cooks with his teenage granddaughter, Shori. This hour, On Point, family cooking with a famous chef. You can join us on air or online. Is cooking a family tradition in your house? What recipes have been handed down through the generations? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And it's my great pleasure to say that Chef Jacques Pepin, the PBS cooking star and recipient of the French Legion of Honor, is joining me here in the studio. His new book is A Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shori. You can find a recipe from the book on our website, onpointradio.org. Jacques Pepin, what a treat to have you with us. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
I'm looking forward to this hour. And I'm sure, Jacques, that many of our listeners first encountered you, first heard about you back when you were doing your cooking shows, especially with Julia Child. I want to start out by playing a clip of you competing against an electric mixer to beat egg whites on Julia and Jacques cooking at home. Here, Julia Child is playing the referee. She's holding up a toy gun to start the race, and you are going to be competing with an electric mixer. Here you go.
We're going to do soufflés. And as everyone knows, the heart of the good soufflé is
egg white, beaten egg white. And I'm going to do mine in copper. I beat it faster than the machine.
Well, we're going to see if you're faster than the machine.
All right. So,
okay.
Wow.
Over counted. One,
yes.
Two, three. Go!
So who won, Jacques? Do you?
Well, of course we won. No, that was fun. Actually, we started those show right here at BU.
Really?
You know, very
here at Boston University.
Years before, yes. I've been teaching at BU close to 35 years now. Uh-huh. And we did those things called cooking in concert. And that was prior to the Food Channel Network. We did a couple of those in the Thai auditorium here. And then that led to the series that eventually we did for KQED.
Uh-huh. And what kind of relationship did you have with Julia Child? You both were accomplished French chefs. Did you know each other before this? Where did you meet?
Well, we met in 1960. Uh-huh. You know, it's a long time ago. And I came to the U.S. in 1959, and I had a friend of mine, Helen McCullough. She was the food editor of McCall House Beautiful. And she said, do you want to look at that manuscript? It's a new cookbook that someone sent me. And, of course, that was Mastering the Art of French Cooking. Mm-hmm. And she said, the woman is coming from from the West Coast next week. You want to cook with her? That was in New York. And I said, absolutely. She said, you know, that's a very tall woman with a terrible voice. And, of course, that was Julia. And I remember at our first meeting, we spoke French. French was certainly better than my English at the time. I had been here a few months, and she just came back from France, spending several years there. And at that time, of course, she wasn't known because she hadn't done television, she hadn't done a book, and she was not the food editor of a magazine newspaper. So she was pretty unknown at the time.
And what was it like to work with her? Were you competitors? Were you always trying to sort of outdo each other?
No, not really. I mean, this is what happened in the kitchen, you know. I mean, you have fun. I mean, she chopped onion and I steal her onion, or she steal my parsley or whatever. I mean, we did argue all the time.
You did.
You know, she likes white peppercorn and I do black pepper or, you know, thing like this. And she used probably more butter than anyone that I've ever known. But except for that, we always had a glass of wine and had a good time together. In fact, she always said we started cooking together. Because I started an apprenticeship in 1949, a long, long time ago. And she went to France in 1949. So even though she was 20 years older than me, it was the same style that she had learned in Paris at the time when I was working in Paris.
Yeah. Well, Jacques, I want to talk about your book and about cooking with your granddaughter. But before we get there, let's get a couple of things out of the way first about from your own life history. I mean, you were born in, what, around 1935 or so?
Yeah, 35, yes.
So when the war comes, I believe your father went off to join the resistance. Is
yes,
that right?
That's true, yes.
And how did you... What was your life like during the war?
Well, my mother was a waitress.
A waitress?
Yes, and she worked, and she had three boys. I was the middle one, and she had to struggle to feed us. And certainly I remember she had a bicycle with, it wasn't even an inflated tire. It was just like rubber, hard rubber tire. And she would go like 30, 40 kilometers. You know, 20 miles to go to farm and try to get a couple of eggs here and so forth, a couple. So it was hardship, but frankly, you know, I was a little kid, and at that time, this is the way life was, so we didn't know any other way, so...
And that's when you first really encountered food and ingredients and natural food?
Yes, I said the first time I was maybe 6 years old, my mother took me to a farm for the summer because she knew I would be fed. There is cow there and there is so butter and so forth. And she left during the vacation, so I was pretty sad. We went there on our bicycle, actually, I remember. I was, you know, on the handlebar.
And 35 miles.
Yeah, something like that, yes.
Wow.
And so she left, and then the farmer's wife knew that I was pretty sad. She took me to the barn, probably my first encounter that close to a cow. Put my hands on the tits of the cow to show me how to milk it, which is. And then I had that bowl of first time that I had that bowl of lukewarm, foaming liquid, you know, fresh milk. And so maybe that changed my life.
It changed your life, but before too long, 20 years later, approximately, you're cooking for Charles de Gaulle.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Well, actually, during 56 and 59, I cooked for the president in France, and that was under the Fourth Republic, and the government was changing at a rapid pace, and I actually ended up cooking for three presidents. In fact, someone introduced me a while ago and said, that man cooked for three French presidents, and the three of them are dead. So I was introduced.
All right.
Yeah, anyway.
So you've had this very distinguished career as a chef and a presenter of Chef, and now you've written a book about cooking with your granddaughter. How did this come about? Why did you want to write this book?
Well, you know, when Claudine, that's my daughter.
Your daughter.
Who is turning 50 this week. When she was a year and a half, 2 years old, I hold her in my arm and I make her stir the pot and smell it so she would taste it. She would eat it, of course, because, quote, she made it with her dad. So you have to involve the kid when they are very small. And it was the same thing with my granddaughter. You know, she came home when she was 3-4 years old. I say, get me some tarragon in the garden. I go with her. I say, no, that's not tarragon. That's chive. This is parsley. That's, you know, oregano and so forth. So getting involved and going to the market with her, I say, pick me some pear and make sure they are ripe. Smell them, touch them, you know, the tomato, the pear. So that type of involvement. And then she had a little box to stand up at the counter and help me, give me that ingredient, give me this, give me that. Now she's taller than me. So we decided, her father is a chef and he's very, very, he teaches at BU as well. So we decided to do those shows together. We were not even going to do a book. And there is actually 36 DVD in that book. There is certain recipe at the end of the recipe. It says, if you want to know how to do that, go to stuff. And then you can have access to 36 DVD, which is basically what we did first. And my daughter told me, you have to do a book out of that. So eventually we did the book, yes.
And you have
fun.
And you have stories in this book, but you also have recipes and recipes that you have worked up with your granddaughter. I have one right in front of me.
Right.
And these are the cottage cheese pancakes that you cook with your granddaughter. Our producers have actually cooked some up for us to try in the studio. Uh-huh. I haven't tried them. There's some. Well, first excuse me for a second. I'm going to take a bite.
Yeah, good.
Some sauce here. What's the sauce?
Well, it's a berry. You know, you'd serve berry with
berries
it too.
Berries and sauce.
I think one of the first time when I knew my daughter lives in Portland, Oregon, where Sherry was born. And I remember meeting her one of the first time she was like 2 years old. Well, I met her before, but I went there to spend some time with them. And I said, okay, I'm going to take her for breakfast. So I grabbed my granddaughter, took her for breakfast. I said, what do you want? She said, you like fruit? She said, oh, yes. She said, I love blueberry. I said, no kidding. She said, yes, they have a lot of antioxidants. I said, they have what? I mean, it was like 2 years old. So yes, she loved fruit. She's pretty sophisticated. So we did that together.
But these pancakes, you make them with, they're elegant. Cottage cheese.
Yes, cottage cheese. And,
you know, what is the, flour, they're milk. So rich, but they're not like a crepe or something like that. They're healthy, cottage cheese pancakes.
Yes, it's not a big deal. My wife actually does that. So sure. My grandmother said, oh, I love those pancakes. I said, okay, let's do a recipe out of it. That's what we did.
So in the beginning, you just sort of made it up.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Well, they have, let's see, there's a little cottage. It looks like there's some cottage cheese in the middle of it. We're going to, listeners, we're going to like take a break here. We're both chowing down on these
we're
pancakes. They are so
good.
Mouthful. All right, I'll do the talking. Wonderful cottage cheese pancakes. And these, your granddaughter, was this one of the first things that your granddaughter made with you?
No, the first thing would be, well, it would be dessert, basically.
Dessert.
If I'd listened to it, we would do only dessert, you know, so especially chocolate. You know, she loves chocolate.
She wanted to start with the desserts.
Right. But she loved, I mean, in that book, I did not really condescend to kid and do very cute recipe. Those are very good, simple recipe that everyone can do. We have a lot of fish, for example, different recipe with fish because she loves fish and as well as chicken, you know, so.
We're talking with Chef Jacques Pepin about cooking with his granddaughter and the joys of passing down traditions. Here's some Edith Piaf, one of Pepin's favorite musicians to listen to in the kitchen. I'm Tom Jelton. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Tom Jelton. A little music there from Jacques Pepin's videos, cooking with his granddaughter, Shori. Chef Jacques Pepin is with us here in the studio today talking about his new book, A Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shori. You can join our conversation. What's on your menu for the holidays? Will you be cooking together, preparing old family recipes, introducing new ones? Follow us on Twitter, and you can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And Carolyn writes in from Twitter that she remembers baking cookies from my grandma's handwritten recipe. I'm betting that just about everybody has warm memories of cooking with their parents or grandparents from old handwritten recipes.
Yes. I tell you, I think that for a child coming back from school, the best place, the most comfortable place in the kitchen, you know. You go into that kitchen. And
first place you go.
Yeah, you hear you know, the voice of your mother, your father, the clink of the equipment, you know, the smell of the kitchen, the taste. And those tastes become very visceral. You know, they stay with you the rest of your life. You ask anyone coming from anywhere in the world, they have those recipes as child.
We have a lot of people that want to get in on this conversation, not surprisingly. Let's give Joe a shot here first. He's calling from Frederick, Maryland. Joe, you are on with On Point. Thanks for calling.
Tom, thank you very much. Chef, it is indeed an honor and a pleasure. Thank you.
Hi, Joe.
For me, it all started with you, Chef. I'm in my 60s.
Oh, boy.
I used to listen to you on TV, you and Julia Child, watch your shows. I have three daughters. My oldest, 34. My youngest is 26. Over the years, they all spent time cooking with me in the kitchen. Different recipes we accumulated. I put in Microsoft Word. This Christmas, as a surprise, and I think they're listening, so it won't be a surprise anymore, I am putting together 115 recipes with the histories. You know, we cooked X number of times,
oh.
Who came over, who, you know, et cetera, in a binder with photographs, et cetera. But it all started with you, Chef, and
thank
God
you.
Bless you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for calling, Joe. So, Joe, Chef Pepin, he says he's inspired by you. We have another fan on the line. This is Jack. He's calling from Montgomery, Alabama. Jack, you're on the air with On Point.
Hi, Jack.
I want to tell you that I really have been inspired, and you use the word visceral. And when I sit and watch your show, I'm inspired by your technique, by the love that you have. And I was wondering, how much love do you put into your food? Because it seems like you put it into your food, not only just on the television, but I'm sure with your family.
Absolutely. You cannot cook indifferently, you know. So as a professional, you have to be a technician first. But anyone can be a technician. I know a fair amount of professional chefs who are good technician and relatively lousy cook, you know. So, but if you have the technique, then if you have a bit of talent, but you have to bring love into it. As I said, you cannot cook indifferently, you know. And that's why maybe cooking is the purest expression of love. Because you always cook for the other. You always cook for someone, always to give, you know.
And the woman, the girl that you gave so much to in the preparation over the last few years is your granddaughter, Shori.
Yes.
Tell us before we go to her story, how you incorporated her in your teaching lessons. How did you in the beginning teach her? You already mentioned the first thing you did was to teach her about ingredients.
Ingredients, the market, the garden, certainly. And then I did a series called Essential Pépin. That was about 6-7 years ago in San Francisco. So she came there. She did a couple of shows with me. At that point, she was standing on a box to reach the counter. She was about 7 years old. And we had a great time. I could push her finger into the chocolate. To now, she's a young lady. I couldn't do that. Then the next series that I did 4 years later was Heart and Soul. Then she did more show with me, and that was a little more serious. And so we decided to, you know, to do things. She feel comfortable on television. She loved to do that. So we had a good time doing it. And so I choose recipe with her. Do you like this? Do you like that? You want to do that for your mom? You want to do that for your dad? Let's try to do this and so forth. So it was pretty casual, fun. And this is what cooking is all about. Ultimately, it has to be fun. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was also a way of communicating with her. I mean, you know, when you're past 80 years old, I know you talk to a teenage, you know. She's much faster with her finger and her iPhone or iPad and all that stuff. But I'm still faster with a knife, you know.
There
so
you go.
I decided to, at least it's a canvas for us where we can communicate and do. And, you know, being in the kitchen together, communicating, and more so sitting around the table and still communicating, that brings discussion about school, about all kind of things. And, you know, when I'm in the kitchen, I say, okay, we have tomato there. What do you think the tomato, is that a fruit or a vegetable? Where do you think it come from? So they give me some butter. Give me a tablespoon of butter. So how many tablespoons you have in that stick? How many stick in a pound? You know, and the water, how many tablespoons do I have in that cup of water? So we can bring some mathematics with some
science,
you know, geography, science or whatever, yes.
Do you think she's going to be a chef like her dad?
Absolutely. No? She want to be a surgeon now.
Ah.
Yeah. Well, I know she will know how to bone out a chicken to start with. So
well, you can teach her how to use a knife then.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, some of the lessons included in Jacques Pepin's book are not only about cooking recipes, but how to act properly at the table. Let's listen here to a clip of Shori coaching her grandfather on his table manners in the Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shori video series.
Now you're going to tell me about how to act properly at the table?
Yes, you have to sit up straight.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. All right. Okay.
And you should get your elbows off the table.
Oh.
Yeah.
You should? Oh, yeah, okay. Now, can I start to eat? I eat with both fingers more, you know, in the style of Europe. But, you know, this way.
Don't talk with your mouth full.
Don't talk with your mouth full.
Right.
Did you really need your granddaughter to tell you that?
Oh, she had a bowl, you know. I was the guinea pig here. You know, don't slouch, don't put your elbow on the table, don't speak with your mouth, don't interrupt me, don't so.
Well, somebody taught her those good manners.
Yes.
But this was a two-way street, and here you are quizzing Shori on herbs, and you mentioned you used these occasions to teach Shori about science and nature, etc. Here you're cooking spaghetti bolognese together, and this is a clip from A Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shori. It's a video series.
Should I just add this into the sauce, the thyme?
The thyme, sure. Okay. Fresh thyme. And we have celery, You know what this one is? The other one? The other
sage.
Herb there?
Sage.
And this?
This is also sage.
Right, this is sage, the flower of sage in the garden. Now I have those beautiful flowers.
Can we just put the flowers in?
Oh, yeah, you can.
So that there was an example where you were teaching her to identify a sage. She didn't know what it was. You had her taste it, and she recognized that it was sage.
I didn't remember that. That's good. Thank you. Yes, of course. No. And her father had a big garden, too. As I say, her father is a chef as well. So she liked to work in the garden.
But in spite of all this inspiration, in spite of the examples that you and her father present to her, she's not sure she wants to be a chef. You say she wants to be a surgeon.
Now, yes, she wants to be a surgeon.
She's how old, 13?
At 13, yeah. So it may change again. But she's quite good in school. She always go very high in mathematics. She went to the spelling bee, I think, as she went to the state competition or whatever. So she's good.
Well, let's bring our listeners back in. As I say, so many want to join our conversation. And let's go now to Linda, who's on the line from Charlotte, North Carolina. Linda, you're here on the conversation with Chef Pepin. What do you have to say to him?
This is a dream come true for me. Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Thank you. How are you?
Chef,
you're kind of giggly.
In many ways, I'm just so excited.
Good.
You have inspired me to cook at home, and as a result, I have lost weight, and the food is obviously so much better because I learned it from you. And also, I had never gotten my degree because I had a good job and was doing very well and had no reason to finish my education. But after reading your autobiography, I'm going back to school to go ahead and get my degree anyway.
Good. Very good.
So
we're proud of you.
That's so inspiring.
Well, thank you very much, Linda. So you, Jacques, have inspired people in different ways, not just to cook, but to take education seriously and so forth. You know, here's a comment from our website that you might have a thought about, and it sort of relates in a way to what Linda was saying. Krieger says, we're moving to a new society, people who are rich enough to never cook themselves and people without the means to cook. Is cooking in danger, you know, with all the changes taking place in society and the economy? Is the art of cooking, you know, in any way sort of in jeopardy?
I don't think so. In fact, I think it probably the reverse. I mean, I am an optimist by character, but I remember when I was a child, my mother had a restaurant, and before going to school, my two brother and I would go to the market. The market was about 7-8 blocks from the restaurant along the river. It was an open market, and we had no car, of course. And so my mother would walk the market about half a mile one way, and buy on the way back. She would buy a case of mushroom, which were getting dark. She knew the guy had to sell it, so she would try to get it for a better price and get back to the restaurant, and she start cooking for the day. Now, she did not have a refrigeration. She had a restaurant. She had an ice box, that is a container with a block of ice. Mm-hmm. So she had a couple of chicken for the day, a few fish, whatever she had. She had to finish that by the end of the day. And that she started doing her vegetable. So everything was local, everything was organic, everything was fresh. I always say my mother was an organic garden. Of course, the word organic did not exist. Chemical fertilizer did not exist. And to a certain extent, in many ways, there is about 10,000 farms market now in the country, which, you know, 15 years ago, there were like 300, 400, 500. So it's going back this way to organic food, to local food, to that type of thing. So maybe there is more of a dichotomy than there used to be of people getting involved into that type of life. New wine, you know, we do extraordinary wine in this country now, bread, you know, cheese, which did not exist. So there is that type of group which live this way, and other people, like you go to a mall, who eat in two or three fast food restaurants every day, the same type of thing over and over again. So there is probably more of a dichotomy difference now in this country than there was 40 or 50 years ago.
More of a dichotomy between people who don't cook and people who do cook. And you said something interesting, which is, of course, when you were a kid, your mother went to the market for most of her ingredients, and now, and then in between, yes, in the 50s and the 60s and 70s, we went to supermarkets, and now people are going back, finding farmers markets and going back, looking for fresh ingredients again.
That's true. That's true.
So we have another treat to try here. This is some chicken liver mousse, and I'm going to...
Yeah, we did that last night with the student at Boston University.
Yeah, well, I take a bite. You tell us how. Tell us about this last night and your experience with the students. Well, I take a bite.
Yeah, we did. We work with the student. Like tomorrow night, we have a dinner that we're going to have 100 people sit-down dinner. And so yesterday we started. We continue today and tomorrow to finish doing. I have 14, 15 students. I had my friend Jean-Claude helping me. And even my son-in-law is coming to give us a hand tomorrow night. So we do that a couple of times a year. You know, as I say, for over 30 years that I've been at BU doing that. So it's kind of my second home. As you can hear from my accent, I'm not from Boston. I am from Connecticut, actually.
One would know. Right. So this chicken liver mousse, you made it last night in your class. Your students made it following your recipe.
Yes. I used to have a little restaurant, and I like to work with showing people. See, I used to buy like 50 or 100 pounds of chicken bone to make stock, but I would pick up the fat out of the chicken carcass and then melt the fat, add onion, garlic, all kind of thyme, bay leaf in it, then some chicken liver, cook it briefly, emulsify it to do a little container of pâté, which costs basically nothing. Yep. When people came to the restaurant, they had a basket of fresh bread and a little container of this. Yeah. So I like to show also, you know, I mean, study in economy in the kitchen. It's very important for me because of the way I was born and during the war. So I'm very miserly in the kitchen. And that's what I learned from my mother, probably. So that would be an example of it.
And this is mousse. Of course, mousse is a little softer. You can eat it with a spoon, softer than a pâté.
Yes.
Wonderful seasoning, very smooth tasting. What is in this recipe, Jacques?
Well, what's in the recipe? We have shallot, we have garlic, we have thyme, bay leaf, and the chicken fat, the chicken liver, a dash of cognac. And yes, it's called a mousse. Mousse means foam in French. Uh-huh. So it's emulsify very much into a very creamy texture and mixture. And actually, it freezes very well, so...
And this is a fairly big bowl. How would you serve this in a meal?
We would serve that on toast, I mean, at the first course. Actually, this was done mostly with game. If you have woodcock or partridge or thing like this, classically you would roast it and then you would take the liver and emulsify the liver with a little bit of the fat, a dash of cognac to put on a toast and serve with the roasted bird. That was the classic way.
Uh-huh.
So that's the idea with that.
Mm-hmm. Did you cook this with shori?
Yes, actually we did. We did with duck. The last time she was home, I had a duck. And again, that's an example. So I had the duck roasted, but before roasted, I took the liver out of it, the little lump of fat on the side, and said, let's do a little pâté. So we do a little pâté, a little container, about 15, 20 toasts you can do with that one liver. And we have that with the aperitif, you know, before we start eating, so...
So this clearly, this chicken liver mousse clearly reflects your French cooking background and knowledge. But you've been influenced by some other cooking traditions, haven't you, here in America at least?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've been married 51 years and my wife, born in New York, but from a Puerto Rican mother and a Cuban father. And so if you take, I may be considered the quintessential French chef, and then you open my book and you have a black bean soup with banana and cilantro on top, and next to it a southern fried chicken, next week a New England lobster roll, and so forth. So I'm probably the quintessential American chef now.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton. We're in the studio with Chef Jacques Pepin talking about his expansive cooking career. You can join our conversation. We have a lot of people who want in on the conversation. There might be some lines still open. What's your favorite moment from his cooking shows? Follow us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And Chef Jacques Pepin is here with me talking about his new book, A Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shuri. There is a recipe on our website for Chef Pepin's creamy tomato soup. That's on our website, onpointradio.org. And let's go now to, as I say, a lot of listeners want to get in on this conversation. Paul is on the line from Montreal, Quebec. Here, Paul, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Bonjour, cher Pépin.
Bonjour, monsieur. Vous allez bien?
Oui, très bien. Merci beaucoup. About 25 years ago, I lived in New York, and I met a lovely French lady, a Parisienne, who we started going out, and one of her first presents to me was a book of yours called Simple and Healthy Cooking.
Oh, boy.
And I don't want to say that that may have induced her into marrying me, or at least saving the marriage, but I have to say it was really a special part of our life that we could share and cook cook recipes. And certainly for me, the difficult art of, for example, creating sauces and these, and you know, the French are very open about their criticism, so she would always be improving my recipes through her comments. So I just
good.
Thank you. And I have two boys who've cooked with us, and now they're getting better than I am. So,
Paul, can I ask you, when someone sort of offers some suggestions about your cooking, are you offended? How do you take that? I'm sure some cooks might not deal with...
Well, at the beginning, as Chef Pepin would know, the French are very direct, and they're... So it took me a while to get used to her style of criticism.
Right.
So,
if you have enough wine, it's okay.
Americans tend to be very polite, and but after all, I realized, well, she's got a point. You know, it's okay. Right. It needs a little of that. And no, you can't do that. But I was curious to what, Chef Pepin, what style do you use when you have to express criticism to it? A chef that you really don't like, but you don't want to insult them either.
Of course, you cannot please everyone. And that particular book I did for the Cleveland Clinic for cardiac patient weight loss, so it was a special type of cooking, you know. So yes, criticism is good, and you have to have a thicker skin when you work in restaurant because, I mean, basically, if you come to my restaurant and I do a rack of lamb you want for you, I'm going to do it medium rare because that's how I like to eat it. But if you want it well done or very, very rare, I will do it the way you want. You are the one paying for it too, and that's the way it should be. I mean, I've known some chefs who refuse to do it differently than the way, and that's not the right way to be. I mean, we're here to serve and to give you what you like to eat. So, yes.
But conversely, Chef Pepin, how about put yourself in the shoes of a consumer? Mm-hmm. How do you handle when you taste something? Maybe it's a chef who is a friend or a colleague, someone you have some personal feeling for, and you don't like it. Will you say so?
Well, not really, but there is certain way. I mean, basically, you know, cooking is it's purely a narcissistic reflection on your own self. I am going to choose that particular restaurant. I will go to the three best restaurants in Boston with you. And there are three good, but one of them, I probably will say, this is the greatest one. And you pick up another one. What I'm saying is that the one that I choose corresponds exactly with my sense of aesthetic, my sense of taste. Do I think it's the good? As I said, to a certain extent, you cannot escape yourself, and it's a narcissistic reflection on your own taste. You know, that's the way it is.
Yeah. So we're going to be talking, we're going to be hearing from your granddaughter, Shuri. She's 13 years old. Mm-hmm. Is that right? And when was the first time that she would actually say, oh, I'm helping Grandpa cook?
Oh, no, she was already 4 or 5 years old.
4 or 5 years old.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And what was it?
Chocolate, I think, was the first time, yes.
Well, as a matter of fact, we actually have a clip of Shuri when she's 6 years old. She's cooking chocolate nut pies with you, her grandfather, on your PBS show, Essential Papin. Here he is.
Now, into this, the chocolate. I know you're not crazy about chocolate, but...
That's funny.
You like chocolate?
Yes.
Okay, so we put a little bit of vanilla in there. That's vanilla. Now I want to put a bit of corn syrup. You want to stir it? Okay, that's a good idea.
So, Jacques, what were you cooking there?
I was cooking a little chocolate cake there, you know, that I did with her. And she, as I say, she likes chocolate, so I did 4 or 5 different things with chocolate. One of them, we blow out balloon, and we dip the bottom of the balloon in chocolate, then deflate the balloon, and you have a chocolate cup that we fill up with whipped cream or with ice cream or thing like that. You know. So.
And given how much she likes chocolate, you have several recipes in your book of chocolate-based desserts.
Absolutely.
I think we have one of them here. Our producers made, I got to get a napkin here. Our producers made the chocolate nut and fruit treats from your book for us to try. Tell us about these while I take a bite.
Yeah, it's quite easy. I mean, we melt chocolate and you can melt your chocolate in the microwave oven. And you can have white chocolate, dark chocolate, semi-sweet chocolate. And we pour that into little paper cup, about a tablespoon and a half in each cup. And prior, before the chocolate get hard, then we put, let's say, a raspberry in it or a little piece of strawberry, a couple of almond or hazelnut, a little sprig of mint. Any of this, it decorate the top. It get embedded in the chocolate. Put them in the refrigerator, 20 minutes. You take the little paper, you know, paper cup out, and you have beautiful dessert and very inexpensive.
So you have a little raspberry on top of these, and it is so elegant, and the flavor of the raspberry is just it just mixes so perfectly with the chocolate.
Okay, I'm going to tell Shari that she did a good job.
Well, I think it was our producers who made this. So, I mean, that raises the question of, is the talent in the recipe or is the talent in the cooking?
Well, both, you know. You have to be able to follow the recipe. But basically, I would tell people that when you do a recipe out of a book, you have to follow it exactly the way it is, at least the first time you do it, to do justice to whoever wrote the recipe. If it comes out good, you're likely to do it again. So the second time, you may take a faster look. Maybe the third time, you say, well, how long was that in the oven or whatever? And by the fourth time, maybe you, quote, improve the recipe. You say, I think I'll put more tomato in there. I think I won't put any of this. And a year later, you don't even know where that recipe comes. It has become your recipe. That is, you have massaged it enough to fit your own sense of taste or aesthetic, and it becomes yours. And that's the type of progression that you should have doing a recipe. And if people do that with my recipe, then I'm gratified.
So when you do a recipe, is it the end result of experimenting a number of times? Because as you say, you are try to be very precise about the quantities and so forth. So do you first experiment before you decide what to put down in writing?
No, we start with an idea, you know. And so I start with an idea. And there is a paradox there, certainly, because when I start with an idea, I am totally free of doing whatever I want. And I have a bunch of ingredients in front of me. But by the time I take A and B and put it in a skillet and write it down on a piece of paper, then I start to narrow it down and it starts cooking. And then, let's say, it starts getting dry. So I put 3 tablespoons of water. Then I add it to my recipe. Well, it may never get dry when you do it, but I am reacting to the ingredient. I'm doing it too. And eventually I say, that's fine. It's over. So now, by now I have a typewritten page that I give to you. But the reversal is that the freedom that I had to start with all those ingredients, is totally gone. Now you're totally structured with a typewritten page, and it's a kind of reversal. That's why you have to do it this way and eventually make it your own. You know?
Well, when you started cooking, did you go to cookbooks?
No, cookbook did not really exist.
They didn't really exist.
I don't think I ever had. No, it existed, but I never used a cookbook until I came to America.
Really?
Yeah, because then I worked for Howard Johnson, and I had to work for doing things in large production and stuff. So I started doing book, but never before. Yeah.
What was it like going from cooking for Charles de Gaulle and then Le Pavillon in New York, and then you end up at Howard Johnson? How did that happen?
It happened because Mr. Johnson, Howard D. Johnson, the owner, used to be a client of the Pavillon all the time, and he decided to have Pierre Frenet, who was the executive chef, and me, and actually it was early 1960, And actually, I was asked to go to the White House for Kennedy, and then I went to Howard Johnson. I mean, to validate my choice, I have to say that at that time, the cook was really at the bottom of the social scale, and any good mother would have wanted their child to marry a lawyer, a doctor, certainly not a cook. You know, so when I was with the president in France, I've never had kudos in the dining room. You would never be invited. I was never on a magazine, newspaper, a radio, or television. That did not exist. This period, the cook was in the kitchen. So not going to the White House, I did not really realize the potential, because at the time, this is the way things were. Conversely, going to Howard Johnson, I learned about mass production, marketing, the chemistry of food, American eating habits. I opened the World Trade Center with Joe Baum in the early 70s. I opened a restaurant on Fifth Avenue in New York called La Potagerie. Then I was a consultant at the Russian Tea Room. I'm saying all of that to say that I could never have done those jobs if I didn't have the training of Howard Johnson in addition to my training as a chef, you know.
And this last book, you had established a real reputation and great fame on your own, but your most recent book is all about cooking with Shori. And that idea of cooking with one's grandchildren is something that has clearly touched a point with many of our listeners, like Lori, who is calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Lori, do you have a story about cooking with your grandmother?
Hi, Tom. Hi, Chef.
Hi, how are you?
My grandmother was, my grandmother was Armenian. She came from Armenia, and she taught me how to cook a lot of the Armenian dishes, and one of the things she did was teach me how to stuff grape leaves and do the triangle phyllo dough filled with cheese. Mm-hmm. And when she was teaching me, she would watch how I was doing it so I would do it correctly, and she would be focusing on me so much that she'd forget how to do it herself. So when the finished product came out of the oven, everyone thought mine were the pieces that were all sort of messed up and crumpled, and she had to explain to everybody that those were mine. Oh. And that hers were the other ones.
You see? And I'm sure that those tastes will stay with you the rest of your life, you know, so.
Oh, they will. I mean, the first time she taught me how to make stuffed grape leaves, I decided I was going to make them when I was living in California, so I called her in Massachusetts, and she walked me through the recipe for 2.5 hours.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. But that must have thrilled her, Lori. I mean, that you would call her and ask her for guidance on cooked stuffed grape leaves. I'm sure that thrilled her.
She was the most wonderful, amazing woman, and I would spend every Saturday with her trying different recipes. So I love the fact that you've done this beautiful book with your granddaughter.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, there you go, Chef. Let's go now to Law, who is calling. I want to get as many listeners as I can in on this conversation. Law is on the phone from Brooklyn, Maine. Law, thanks for calling On Point. You're on with Chef Jacques Pepin.
Hello. How are you?
Hi, Tom. Hi, Chef. I'm great. So I just wanted to quickly say, Chef, I read your book about your life. I'm a Culinary Institute graduate and a working chef, and I'm also a mom, and I have a 3.5-year-old, almost 4-year-old, who basically will spend every minute in the kitchen with me, and I just took a lot of inspiration of, starting young with the kids and reading about you as a kid starting so young and sort of the confidence that you had or the people around you had to kind of empower you to be in the kitchen. And
thank
I just wanted
you.
To say every time I'm in the kitchen with him, I think about you and I think about sort of the culture of cooking and how to pass it along to him. And so I appreciate your book. I appreciate what you do. And I think you're a really stand-up human being. So thanks for
thank you
doing what you do. You're an inspiration.
Thank a lot you. Of fans calling in today, Chef.
Well, this is what happened in the teaching process, you know. And cooking school did not exist when I came to America. And then I know that we started that program at BU 32, 34 years ago. I've been teaching here. And there is different school, the School of Hospitality. And we even did in the 80s, Julia Child and I created the school, a Master of Liberal Art with a concentration in gastronomy here at BU. And to a certain extent, it's still one of the only one in the country where you could get the resources of the university with different, different subjects, filtering their subjects through food. From the School of Theology, we can talk about food in the Bible, to the School of Medicine, to Anthropology, History, Sociology, the Art Department. So it is a great program that we still do at BU, and I'm here teaching yesterday, today, tomorrow, and I do that a couple of times a year, right here.
Well, Chef Pepin, we're at the end of our program now. I think we want to point out that you have a birthday coming up. When is it?
Yep, next Monday.
Next Monday, yeah. And you'll be 82 years old.
Right, and my daughter observes the 15th, so 3 days before me.
Are you going to do a joint birthday celebration?
Yes.
And who's going to make the cake?
I don't know if we make it. We're not big with sweet, so it's going to be more like caviar and champagne, like that.
That sounds pretty good, too. Chef Jacques Pepin, his book is A Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shorey. Thank you so much, sir, for coming, and it's been a real treat.
Thank you for having me. Thank you, and happy cooking to everybody.
You can continue this conversation, and you can get the On Point podcast on our website, onpointradio.org. Or you can follow us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, 20-plus years after the whack heard round the world, the director of the new movie, I, Tonya, and sports reporters who covered the saga. That's tomorrow on Point. I'm Tom Gelton. This is On Point.